Okay, why don't we get started? Welcome to our regular Thursday lecture series. Today we have a very special guest, Professor Nikolai Petro, who is a professor of politics at the University of Rhode Island, where he teaches comparative politics. He received his PhD in foreign affairs from the University of Virginia in 1984, and his professional focus has been on the role that history, culture, and symbols play in democratic development. Professor Petro has written a number of books in both English and in Russian. Some of the highlights include his 2004 book with Cornell University Press entitled Crafting Democracy, How Novgorod Has Coped with Rapid Social Change. Another highlight is the 1995 Harvard University Press book, The Rebirth of Russian Democracy, An Interpretation of Political Culture. He's also published extensively articles in foreign policy and policy journals such as the Wilson Quarterly, Comparative Strategy, Post-Soviet Affairs, World Development, the Fletcher Forum, and the Harvard International Review. Today, his lecture is entitled, The Legal Case for Russia's Intervention in Georgia. So welcome, Professor.
Thank you very much. Thank you to the Center for Russian, Eastern Europe, and Central Asia for inviting me and for giving me the chance to visit one of the states I haven't been to yet, Wisconsin. It's lovely to walk around campus today. I'm not a legal scholar, but I did take an interest in the Russian intervention in Georgia last August and took the time to examine various aspects of the intervention to draw up a timeline, which, although it was originally completed in August, still is available on my website, I think has actually held up pretty well since then. And one of the things that struck me in looking at the various issues involved in this conflict was that Russia was making a specific legal argument that justified her intervention. And that argument was essentially not being at all taken seriously in the Western press. And so I wondered about that and took the time to really look at it very carefully. And the result is this paper, which I then submitted brazenly as a law review article, although I have no training in this matter, and it was eventually accepted in the Fordham International Law Journal. It's going to be appearing this month or next. So you can see all the footnotes there that I won't have time to elaborate on in my talk. It is striking that so few Western analysts bothered to consider Russia's legal arguments for what it calls its peace enforcement operation, a term introduced by former UN Secretary General Boutros Ghali 16 years ago. And I think this is an oversight, because had greater attention been paid, it would have revealed the unusual degree to which Russia sought the support of international institutions for what its leadership believed to be a solid legal case for humanitarian intervention. Since an appeal to legal argument is often considered a hallmark of the Western political tradition and a weakness of the Russian political tradition, Russia's emphasis on the legal justification for intervention should be viewed as a significant step in the adaptation of Russian foreign policy to post-Soviet norms. So first I'd like to examine those arguments that Russia made, legal arguments for intervention, and then review some common criticisms of them. The rationale for Russian intervention was laid out by Russian ambassador to the UN, Vitaly Churkin, in his letter of August 11, 2008, to the president of the UN Security Council. In it, Churkin cites the scale of the attack on Russian peacekeeping forces and Russian citizens, as well as statements of aggressive intent by Georgian political and military leaders to, quote, demonstrate that we are dealing with the illegal use of military force against the Russian Federation. In those circumstances, the Russian side has no choice but to use its inherent right to self-defense enshrined in Article 51 of the Charter of the United Nations, end quote. Article 51 specifies that member nations have a, quote, inherent right of individual or collective self-defense if an armed attack occurs, end quote, and that this right is in no way impaired by the Security Council's failure to act. Its invocation, however, shall be immediately reported to the Security Council. So by submitting this letter, Russia fulfilled at least this essential requirement of Article 51. The issue that remains in dispute is whether or not the shelling of South Ossetian capital of Tsinkval by Georgia in the early evening of August 7, 2008, and the advance of its forces into South Ossetia shortly after midnight to, quote, restore constitutional order in the entire region, end quote, as Georgian military commanders put it, constitutes aggression. Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, argues that Georgia's actions do qualify as aggression based on United Nations General Assembly Resolution 3314, appropriately entitled, The Definition of Aggression. The following two articles in that resolution are directly relevant to his argument. Article 2 states, quote, the first use of armed force by a state in contravention of the Charter shall constitute prima facie evidence of an act of aggression, end quote. By the general consensus of international observers and confirmed subsequently by Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili in his testimony last November to the committee of inquiry set up by the Georgian parliament, Georgia's shelling of the South Ossetian capital of Tsinkval was the first use of armed force by a state in this conflict. Article 3 states, quote, an attack by the armed forces of a state on the land, sea, or air forces, or marine and air fleets of another state constitutes aggression. Churkin argues that the attack on Russian peacekeepers who were in South Ossetia, in accord with agreements signed and ratified by Georgia, alongside OSCE observers, constitutes an attack on Russian armed forces. Georgia's counterclaim that it has the right to use whatever military force it deems fit to restore constitutional order in a separatist region because the latter is not a state is contradicted by an explanatory note to Article 1 in that General Assembly resolution, clarifying that the term state is used without prejudice to questions of recognition. In addition, Article 5 stipulates that, quote, no consideration of whatever nature, whether political, economic, military, or otherwise, may serve as justification for aggression. And, separate point, a war of aggression is a crime against international peace. Aggression gives rise to international responsibility, end quote. Relying on these definitions, Russia argues that South Ossetia had the right to defend itself and to appeal for international assistance against Georgia's efforts to change the status quo by force. All the more so since General Assembly Resolution 3314 explicitly condemns the use of force to suppress rebellious regions and stipulates that any territorial or other advantage gained from such use of force should be considered unlawful. In the case of South Ossetia, it can be further argued that the prohibition on the use of force should be accorded greater weight, since the peacekeeping forces were there in accord with agreements signed by Georgia and that had international standing. The latter is reflected in point 3 of the 1994 Joint Control Commission memorandum, where the CSCE mission in Georgia is listed as, quote, taking part in the work of the JCC. In 1996, the OS, now the OSCE, the successor to the CSCE, representative Ambassador Dieter Bohlen also signed the Moscow memorandum, which listed the OSCE as, quote, a party assisting in its implementation, end quote. Georgia was still a party to both of these accords in early August. It was not until August 27, 2008, that Georgia's prime minister, Lado Gurginidze, instructed the foreign ministry to notify Russia of Tbilisi's intention to withdraw from the 1992 Sochi agreement. This agreement, sometimes known as the Dagamys agreement, is the foundational document that guides the actions of the four parties in this conflict: Russia, Georgia, North Ossetia, and South Ossetia. In the intervening years, it has been supplemented by more than 80 protocols, memoranda, and agreements, all available online on the official website of the South Ossetian Joint Control Commission. Several of these documents specify the competencies of the peacekeepers and military observers in the region. The 1994 Declaration on Basic Principles states that it is the responsibility of the peacekeepers to, quote, control the situation in the conflict zone and areas contiguous to it, end quote, and specifies that peacekeepers shall take measures toward the introduction and support of a heightened security regime in the conflict zone and, if necessary, in contiguous areas, and prevent the introduction into the conflict zone of military groups and other unauthorized formations capable of destabilizing the situation through their actions. The unified command of the JCC is to be headed by a senior Russian military officer who has sole authority on the use of military force in the event of a violation of the ceasefire, as well as on the decision to pursue, I quote, criminal elements beyond the conflict zone, end quote, and on the placement of forces. At his news conference on August 28, 2008, the deputy chief of the general staff of the Russian armed forces, Anatoly Nogavitsyn, referred to Article 3 of the 1994 JCC Declaration on Basic Principles as the legal basis for all actions taken by the Russian peacekeepers, including their deployment in the security zone. Since these accords were binding on Georgia at the time, Russia argues that the response of the Russian forces to Georgia's attack was legal, a point conceded by some Western analysts, like Daniel Erasmus Kahn, professor of international law at the University of the German Armed Forces in Munich, who notes that regimes like Abkhazia and South Ossetia that have established their de facto independence over many years are typically considered protected from the use of force and have the right to self-defense. And Germany's military attaché in Moscow at the time, Brigadier General Heinz Wagner, who argued that, quote, without a doubt, end quote, Russia was justified in responding to the Georgian attack on the peacekeepers who, quote, on the basis of their armament and equipment, were not in a position to protect or even defend themselves, end quote. Interestingly, on August 20th, 2008, the freshly appointed, barely gotten off the plane, appointed U.S. ambassador to Russia, John Baer, said in an interview with a Russian paper that Russia had, quote, responded to the attacks on Russian peacekeepers in South Ossetia legitimately, end quote. This was originally posted on the U.S. embassy's website, however, his remarks were later disavowed by Secretary of State Condi Rice. More recently, two British officers who were on location at the time of these events as members of the OSCE observer team, British Army Captain Ryan Grist and former RAF Wing Commander Stephen Young, said that Georgian forces were firing rockets at civilian areas in South Ossetia prior to any Russian military activity necessitating a Russian response. The limited scope of Russia's intervention in the area, which, by the way, that's one of the show-and-tell pieces I brought, indicating the perimeter of the buffer zone and the security zone. The limited scope of Russia's interventions, confirmed by the circumscribed deployment of Russian troops within the original security zone and the area contiguous to it, referred to as the buffer zone. Of the 17,000 troops that Russia had in the conflict zone at the height of this conflict, according to NATO sources, roughly 1,000, or less than 6%, were deployed in both the security and buffer zones. So essentially in the buffer zone. Russia's strictly defensive posture is also apparent in the limited scope of the attacks on Georgian military infrastructure within the buffer zone, ignoring militarily significant targets deeper within Georgia. Had Russia wanted to occupy the entire country, it could have done so with little difficulty after the collapse of the Georgian army on August 11, 2008. Let me now turn to some recurrent criticisms of Russia's position, citing two prominent critics. One, Gareth Evans, formerly Australia's foreign minister and co-chair of the International Commission that worked out the R2P, Right to Protect, doctrine. The other, Antonio Cassese, served as the first president of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia and is currently a professor of law at the University of Florence. Evans argues that the protection of Russian citizens is not a valid rationale for intervention. R2P, he says, may only be invoked if a state is unable or unwilling to protect its own citizens, but not to protect one's citizens in another country, particularly if there is reason to suspect that citizenship may have been granted with an eye toward justifying such a claim. Cassese makes a similar point, saying, quote, South Ossetians have Russian nationality only because Russia recently bestowed it on them unilaterally. Some 50 to 80% of Abkhaz, and perhaps as many as 95% of South Ossetians, hold Russian citizenship alongside their own. How did this unusual situation come about? When the first fighting erupted between Georgia and its two separatist enclaves in 1991, the entire region was still part of the USSR, and all its inhabitants were Soviet citizens. A Russian law passed in 1992 permitted all residents of ex-Soviet republics to apply for Russian citizenship, providing that they were not already citizens of another republic. Many Abkhaz and South Ossetians argue that because their armed struggle for independence began before Georgia declared its own independence from the USSR, they were never citizens of an independent Georgia. The citizenship process is an arduous one, requiring frequent trips to Russia. Since residents of Abkhazia and South Ossetia were being denied travel documents by the Georgian government, Russia allowed them to submit emergency applications through the Abkhaz Foreign Ministry in Suhumi. Their strong preference for Russian citizenship is no doubt an emotional backlash to the fighting of the early 1990s, exacerbated by the application of economic and political sanctions designed to force Abkhazia and South Ossetia to reintegrate back into Georgia. Without a valid passport, local residents could not travel abroad, could not collect pensions, could not access any public medical services. As living conditions in these regions deteriorated, Tbilisi reasoned that the local residents would have no choice but to relocate to Russia if they wanted to, or accept Georgian nationality. Sergei Bagapsh, then Abkhazia's prime minister, described a meeting that he had with Georgia's president, Eduard Shevardnadze, in 1998 to resolve the passport crisis. According to Bagapsh, Shevardnadze angrily refused to issue any Georgian passports to the Abkhaz, saying they should make do with UN travel documents. Bagaksh told him that in that case, quote, we will ask Russia to help, and in 5 years, most of our citizens will have Russian passports, end quote. And this is precisely what happened. Tbilisi applied similar pressures to South Ossetia, with the result that they too have become, as the deputy speaker of the South Ossetian parliament puts it, 101% Russian citizens. Going back to Evans's argument, since the use of economic sanctions is explicitly prohibited by Article 4 of the Sochi Agreement and by Article 1 of the Moscow Memorandum of May 16, 1996, it would seem to be a perverse form of protection that punishes them twice, first for having been denied Georgian citizenship, and then again for having accepted Russian citizenship in order to survive. Evans also argues that the threat posed by Georgia to the South Ossetian population was not, quote, of a nature and scale as to make legitimate its use of military force, end quote. Kassirze makes a similar claim, saying that neither genocide nor ethnic cleansing seem to have occurred, and that even, quote, if war crimes were perpetrated, they do not justify a military invasion, end quote. The total number of civilian casualties from the war has not yet been finalized. To date, various investigations have identified between 159 and 365 casualties by name. According to South Ossetia's Prosecutor General, Taimuraz Khugayev, there are more than 200 burial sites left to exhume in South Ossetia and 50 in North Ossetia, which could bring the total civilian casualty figure among South Ossetian civilians to over 500. While this is a significant figure for a population that numbers only a few tens of thousands, most Western observers are reluctant to call it genocide. It is worth noting, however, that the 1948 UN Genocide Convention, Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide, designates as genocide any of the following acts committed with, quote, intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group, including A, killing members of the group, B, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, and C, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. Whether or not the policies of the current Georgian leadership constitute genocide, they do follow in the path set by Georgia's first president, Zviad Gamsakhurdia, of driving the, quote, non-native Abkhaz and South Ossetian populations out of the region to make room for the Georgians. Gamsakhurdia called this, quote, creating a Georgia for Georgians, adding that, quote, subversive minorities, like the South Ossetians, this is a lengthy quote, quote, should be chopped up, they should be burned out with a red-hot iron from the Georgian nation. We will deal with all the traitors, hold all of them to proper account, and drive out all the evil enemies and non-Georgians, end quote. In 2004, the newly elected president of Georgia, Mikhail Saakashvili, rehabilitated Gamsakhurdia, hailing him as a great statesman and patriot. And even after the war, in August, Saakashvili shows little sign of recognizing the right of Ossetians to exist, commenting on a subsequent interview with a French journalist that, quote, quote, Ossetia is a fiction. The Georgians have always comprised the majority of the population. Stalin did not create these Abkhaz and Ossetian autonomies within Georgia to please Georgia. On the contrary, he did not trust it. Stalin knew what he was doing. He needed these levers, end quote. Ultimately, only the opening of Georgian state archives will reveal whether or not Georgian forces were ordered to terrorize Ossetian population in this particular instance, although there is evidence that senior military officials did threaten the entire Abkhaz population with physical elimination for their rebellion in 1992. It is clear from the Ossetian response, however, that 17,000 fled north to Russia in the first hours of the attack, swelling to over 35,000 by the end of that week, that they regarded the possibility of the restoration of Georgian sovereignty to be a dire threat to their existence. This, to me, seems to beg the question, if the induced flight of nearly half an ethnic population, labeled, quote, ungrateful guests and, quote, Indo-European swine, by the country's former president, is not considered ethnic cleansing, then what is? Next, Evans argues that Russia's actions cannot be deemed humanitarian intervention because no UN Security Council resolution preceded it. Cassese agrees, and adds that the 1992 agreement authorizes only the monitoring of internal tensions, not the massive use of military force. While Georgia may have been reckless by sending its troops into South Ossetia, it did not, he says, breach international law. But some legal scholars have argued that consent-based peacekeeping does not require Security Council approval. Rather, it falls under Chapter 6 of the Charter, which provides, as a first resort, regional agencies in situations that may threaten regional peace and security. Such regional organizations include the Commonwealth of Independent States, the Collective Security Treaty Organization, and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, all of which have condemned Georgia's actions as aggression and, to varying degrees, supported Russia's role in the Caucasus. Nor has a UN resolution always preceded legitimate action. The Economic Community of West African States Monitoring Group, ECOMOG, a West African multilateral military force set up in 1990 to help end the Liberian Civil War, never received approval of its mission in Liberia, though it was subsequently congratulated by the UN Security Council for its efforts. Nor has France typically waited for a Security Council resolution before any of its many interventions in Chad. The point being that Russia's actions to stem the humanitarian catastrophe appear to have been in good faith and undertaken with every expectation of subsequent international approval. It is also hard to support the argument that Georgia did not breach international law when, again, General Assembly Resolution 3314 specifically states that no consideration of whatever nature, political, economic, military, or otherwise, may serve as a justification for aggression. Indeed, an inquiry by the Parliamentary Assembly of Europe in August of 2008 to that very point found that, quote, the start of shelling of Tsinkhvali by the Georgian military in August 2008 constituted a disproportionate use of force by Georgia, albeit within its own territory, and as such a violation of international law and Georgia's commitment to resolve the conflict peacefully. Nor is Cassese accurate in his description of the 1992 Sochi Agreement as being nothing more than an agreement to monitor. As already noted, the 94 JCC Declaration makes it the responsibility of the senior Russian military officer in charge to, quote, prevent the introduction into the conflict zone of military groups and other unauthorized formations capable of destabilizing the situation through their actions, end quote. Once attacked by 13,000 Georgian troops, common sense would seem to dictate that the 588 Russian peacekeepers stationed in South Ossetia had a right to call upon reinforcements. Evans is again wrong when he says that no effort was made by Russia to seek Security Council approval. Russia called the first of three emergency meetings of the Security Council at 5:15 Greenwich Mean Time on August 8th. However, Georgia objected to a three-sentence resolution that would have called on all sides to, quote, renounce the use of force. With the backing of the United States and Great Britain, the meeting adjourned after 45 minutes without taking action. In the days and weeks leading up to the attack, Russia sought international involvement, not just from the United Nations, but from a wide variety of international organizations, including the EU and the OSCE. The Russian delegation had been working within the Security Council to get Abkhazia, Georgia, and South Ossetia to sign legally binding agreements on the non-use of force. This request was repeatedly rejected by President Saakashvili, most recently on July 17, 2008, 2 weeks before the attack. In the very first days of August, Georgia's deputy foreign minister was invited to Moscow to seek a way to defuse the increasingly tense situation. And Russia had agreed to sponsor an international peace conference on August 15th in Berlin with the participation of all parties, including the United States. After the attack, Russia also appealed directly for assistance to the Russia-NATO Council, a forum created to help resolve conflicts which might arise between Russia and NATO. But as with Russia's other efforts to obtain immediate ceasefire, this one was thwarted by the United States. When Evans argues that Russia's legal position is weakened by the fact that it moved into Georgia proper after Georgia had signed a ceasefire agreement presented to it by the OSCE mediators, he fails to mention that Georgia was only willing to accept a ceasefire when its own military incursion had already faltered. In sum, a careful review of the diplomatic record, both before and after August 8th, reveals that Russia went to significant lengths to obtain international intervention and intervened unilaterally only when its efforts to obtain a ceasefire were blocked for political reasons. Finally, when considering the issue of proportionality of Russia's response to the crisis, it is relevant to note that on August 8th, Georgia declared that it was in a full state of war with Russia and launched a full-scale mobilization of its military and reserves. Russia did neither. It is also difficult to argue that Russia's military response was disproportionate when, according to NATO, Russia entered the conflict with roughly 8,000 troops to Georgia's 13,000. To sum up, far from being an example of vigilante justice, Russia's peace enforcement operations in South Ossetia appear to have been a reluctant application of force to uphold its peacekeeping mandate in the region. In the months preceding the attack, Russia sought to have all parties sign a binding treaty disavowing the use of force. Before intervening, Russia desperately sought international support for an immediate ceasefire. When that failed, Russia asked that international forces be sent to the region to rebuff Georgian aggression. Russia acted unilaterally only when all these efforts failed and the ethnic cleansing of the population of South Ossetia appeared imminent. Even then, Russia sought to adhere strictly to the confines of its original peacekeeping mandate. In this context, the broader issue warranting discussion is this: under what circumstances may nations act unilaterally if international consensus is thwarted by deliberate political obstruction? Russia's recent actions in the Caucasus highlight the serious shortcomings of the present international system and set a new standard for action for the compulsory application of international law in the absence of prior consent that will no doubt be much debated. Thank you.
Questions or comments?
You know, all of this is somewhat
legalese.
There's a geopolitical reality, I think, in the Caucasus. Mm-hmm. There is that line at the top of the mountains. Russia has enough trouble on its side of the line. The Georgian state is pretty much fragmented by this current fragmentation. Certainly in Abkhazia, the case for ethnic cleansing of Georgians is much clearer. It seems to me that there's no possibility of establishing a SETI, a nation for 100,000 people, and the annexation by Russia certainly would be a precedent that I don't think any, that the world community would ever accept. So I honestly think that there's no good international alternative than putting Georgia back together. I think this ought to be done under some kind of an international, strong international supervision, not Russian peacekeepers, and that the neutralization of Georgia and its role as an international transit facility for hydrocarbons and rail and so forth, traffic to the Caucasus, I mean to the Caspian region, ought to be guaranteed. I think there's a strong international interest in that. And the current situation just is anomalous and unhappy and ought not to be allowed to exist forever. Mm. There needs to be a proactive approach.
Well, I think placed in a broader historical context, the question is, what are the legitimate, or if you will, viable borders of Georgia? And if someone decides what they are, it's some type of international mandate, then they have to be willing to fight for them. Because not everyone on the ground is going to be happy there in the Caucasus with that description. I don't see... I tend to agree with those observers and scholars who said, obviously what happened in 2008 was bound to happen, because these resentments have been festering for 15 years, not to mention more ancient disagreements and resentments in the region going back to what the South Ossetians called the genocide of the 1920s, that the Georgians conducted against them, and many, many other historical incidents that are passed down to the local populations. So, you know, this situation reminds one of Northern Ireland, of the Middle East. And you can say that, you can pretend and say, well, let's just establish these borders, but then you have to be willing to use force to maintain them for an indefinite period, ostensibly for a long enough period that everyone accepts those borders as appropriate and legitimate, but that's going to be more than one generation. Absent that, I'm not sure what glue you can use to hold, to force these populations together. And I'm talking about those that we consider to be part of internationally recognized Georgia. That conglomerate of people does not actually exist and does not want to exist together as a state. Now, what can you do about that?
Well, take it conversely. Would you support Russian annexation?
If the issue were not framed as let's not reward Russia, but if the issue is framed as what is a viable solution to the problem that the local population will accept, that they see as a viable solution. One approach that has always been suggested by the South Ossetian leadership, but that Russia has been reluctant to accept because it smacks too much of wanting to having prepared this with the pretext of annexation, though I can't imagine why Russia needs a few hundred more square miles of territory and a rambunctious people to add to their present woes. but we have, when I listed the four parties, people often sort of skip over the North Ossetians. They're the actual big brother, if you will, to the South Ossetians in this region. There's no reason for to have a South Ossetia and a North Ossetia except for this Georgian border. And they're one people. Now, that too has to be addressed in some way. because the South Ossetian government has said, we are indeed probably not a viable international state. But with our brothers to the north, you know, just redraw the boundary and we're whole again. Well, if you discount that as a possible solution, then I think you don't really have an option for a true resolution of the conflict that people in the region can accept, that people are affected by it can accept. But again, force and time and money can do a lot. It's just a matter of figuring out how much capital we, the West, want to expend in that region. I suspect that given the current context, both our foreign policy and our economics situation, it's not much for the sake of those people in the region. And that includes the Georgians.
And would you extend your scenario to Abkhazia?
Now, the Abkhaz have always had a stronger case, and they've had more supporters. And my sense of the people who specialize in that region, ethnographers and geographers, they all sort of feel that Abkhazia has a viability that South Ossetia does not, partly because of geography, partly because of temperament. And there's a history of Abkhaz independence. So at least they argue that there is. So maybe that that will come to pass a bit sooner, I suspect, than South Ossetia. Yeah.
How do you interpret Georgia's claim that the Russian forces crossed the Rocky Tunnel mm-hmm. the day before the beginning of the attacks?
As an afterthought, as something that came up, and we can trace this, as a legitimation for Georgia's intervention 4 days after the events themselves. And some people feel that timing is significant, that the initial justification was the need to restore law and order based on the skirmishes that were taking place between South Ossetian militia and Georgian forces. They were shelling each other, and each side will blame the other, and the Georgians will say, well, they fired first, and we had to overcome this and restore peace to the region. But it was only several days later, specifically 4 days later, that this supplemental claim was made, and has since become a mainstay of Georgia's argument. There are other problems with it, namely, if, as subsequently reported, Georgia's attack was based on the intelligence information that Saakashvili had received that Russian forces were passing through the Rocky Tunnel, then why was the Rocky Tunnel never attacked? It's a decisive target. And had it been bombed, had it been closed, the scenario might have been very different. The Georgians never bothered to get to that. They focused their attention on Tsinkvali, probably not expecting much resistance in the town. But when they lost basically a day in Tsinkvali, that definitely did give the Russian forces an opportunity to mobilize and to put forces through the tunnel itself. So one of the committees that is still examining this, and I think I'm not sure it'll be decisive, but it will certainly be interesting because it's been the subject of speculation what their findings will be is the EU Commission that has been looking into this evidence. And again, we don't know what they've found. But one of the press stories leaked by Uwe Klusmann, the Moscow correspondent of Spiegel, about the content suggests that the committee members are prone to condemning Georgia as the first attacker, precisely because of what now they say, appears to be the coincidence between the statement made at the time by the head of the Georgian peacekeeping forces, that this was an action designed to restore order to the entire region, and what is known as Order Number 2 issued at the time. And there are still debates as to whether Order Number 2 even exists. The Russian chief of staff has produced what they call an intercepted version of it. The Georgians say they don't have such an order, don't want to show such an order, and the EU Commission seems to be leaning toward the Russian version at this point. But we shall have to see. I'm sure it'll be a more balanced report, but it'll place some definitive, it'll make some definitive judgments about the sequence of events. And then, of course, lawyers will look back and say, aha, well, now that we have established more or less a reliable evidentiary sort of basis, which laws then appropriately apply to this scenario? That's all I can say. Yes?
The name of Joseph Stalin came up. Do you have some insight as to what his involvement in the area was?
I think not really greatly. Just that I think Stalin, for all intents and purposes, I don't personally think of him as a Georgian nationalist. I tend to think of him as someone who had bigger ambitions and really had to sort of lead the USSR. And in that context, I'm sure he would be just as eager to squash Georgian nationalism as Azeri nationalism or Kazakh or any other in the interests of maintaining and consolidating his power. But that's about all I can. I can't speculate much about this entire about the relationship, except to say that as I read the history of the inter-ethnic history of the Caucasus, many of these people that we are now reading about in the press, their grievances go back quite a ways, centuries. And they have long-standing debates with Georgian rulers, be they monarchs or presidents or general secretaries, as to where the boundaries of authority actually lie, in order not to see their ethnic identity entirely absorbed or subsumed into Georgia. And there are many more that I've come across in my reading, Mingrelians and Svanetians and others whom we don't hear about, and that are also part of the picture, is all I can say. It's a very complex and complicated mosaic, and every now and then some of these groups appear to be willing to defend their right to autonomy by use of force. And others, by contrast, the Adjar, for example, who could very easily have fallen into the same process as Georgian, now the Georgian opposition says, acknowledges, with Putin's assistance, basically, managed to be bought off, essentially, and now have been granted some degree of authority within the Georgian Republic. But I know, without casting, without characterizing the Georgian national leadership too much, I think one of the things that does come out in discussions of this subject is that one of the rallying cries of Georgia's independence, of each successive Georgian independent president, has been that they are the ones who, among other things that they will offer to Georgia, is national unity. And follow me because I will get the job done this time. Unfortunately, so far, they seem to have relied considerably not on the carrot, but on the stick in doing so. And that doesn't seem to have provided very much benefit to them.
So leaving aside the legal issues, which for non-lawyers, perhaps are secondary to the political issues, I'd like to ask, do you think that Russia's policies towards Kosovo on the one hand and towards Chechnya are consistent with the rationale you're articulating here?
Yeah.
Couldn't you substitute Kosovo for South Ossetia in much of what you said and make the case that Russia should support the independence of Kosovo as opposed to opposing it? And couldn't you argue that based on the definition of genocide which you gave us, that what took place in Chechnya twice was tantamount to an effort to eliminate to the Chechens as a people, but part of the Russian state?
Let me take the Kosovo issue first. That criticism has been made, notably in the public commentary in the West. But I think Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has deflected it very effectively, pointing out that Russia was happy with the status quo such as it was, and it really didn't make sense to punish Serbia now, because they were the ones who helped to broker the independence of Kosovo and were on board, and the UN resolutions that were the underpinning of how that issue was to be resolved make specific provisions for the territorial integrity of Serbia, considering its claim to some or all of Kosovo. So the decision to preempt, the decision made by the United States and a handful of other countries to recognize peremptorily the independence of Kosovo really broke free of the UN framework that had been provided and established an artificial deadline. Said, well, we're tired of waiting. It's just, we're going to resolve the issue the way Alexander the Great resolved undid the Gordian knot, it's just too much trouble. And, the argument being, A, this is a bad precedent. You don't just get tired of international problems and sort of swat them away. And the other problem is that, what if, this leads to resentment on the part of the Yugoslav, the reformist, Serbian, Serbian leadership, who after all played by the rules on this issue and got nothing for it. So how are they to be, how are they to feel in this circumstance? And what is that going to lead to for the next generation? Because again, Kosovo is Kosovo, what it is for the Georgian, for the Serbian mind, for the Serbian heart. And that just doesn't go away if you just pretend to resolve it. The Chechnya issue, Russia makes a different type of argument. Again, that issue has come up, so it has been addressed by the Russian Foreign Ministry. The argument there is that whatever the circumstances may have been in terms of the Russian intervention in 96, subsequent events have essentially established a new status quo that results, that in fact demonstrates support for the way things are now, and a disavowal of the independence of Chechnya. So as a historical argument, one could well say, well, that was genocide way back then. But that's essentially a historical argument at this point, and Russia argues that there have been elections, referenda, the situation is stabilized, Russian troops, as you know, are now scheduled. The state of emergency has been ended, and ostensibly...
yesterday.
No, I don't think so. I think there's a... I read about... this back and forth, but I think we're still on track with the formal ending. It may have different parameters in its application, and that's always hard to see. But I think as a political maneuver, it's a done deal. And one of the trade-offs in terms of political practice, what effectively has happened, seems to be, and this is worrisome to some analysts in Moscow, that Chechnya has been granted enormous internal autonomy to do what it wants. And again, you could argue it both ways. You could say that although the independent faction, the Dudayev and the rebels, essentially lost, but what Kadyrov, Ramzan Kadyrov, has effectively managed to gain is much of what they fought for, which helps to perhaps explain the most perplexing aspect of this puzzle at present, at least to me, the willingness of the chief spokesman for Ichkeria, Zakayev, right? Mm-hmm. Zakayev, in London, going on Russian radio and saying, yes, I'm considering the possibility of returning to Chechnya now because, not because I agree with what happened, and we still have to condemn the Russians for their historical treatment of the Chechens, but we now have essentially a government that I consider more or less popular in power and therefore legitimate. Yes.
Good. Oh, okay. So is, I have to. One thing about the when coming back to legality, it's the disproportionate argument that Russia, the criticism that Russia did. Went inside Georgia too much. Went beyond the.
Okay, beyond the security zone.
Yeah, they went to the Black Sea. They went to Poti. You know, mm-hmm. That's the fact. Right? So,
right.
I mean, your rebuttal is that well, they had initially 8,000 troops versus 13,000 troops. Although those 13,000 troops collapsed in what?
3 days.
In 3 days. So we don't know. We don't know what's, but those 8,000 actually stood up and got the result. So, I mean, we could say that's one indicator of how to measure the proportionality of response. But you can say that, you know, if you look at the territory controlled effectively by the Russian forces, it was much bigger than the areas where ethnic cleansing took place, let's say, in the past 15 years.
Right.
I think that's...
the rationale, but may I just, because I get lost sometimes in too many points, but on that, the rationale for extending the buffers, the security zone to a specific buffer zone that extended essentially, I believe, no more than 20, I don't know, miles or kilometers at this point. Anyway, it's in that area.
Well, you have Poti here as a new...
Yeah, the rationale, but the rationale is that those were the areas from which the Georgian forces were receiving support. Those were support lines, support areas. It's a military reason. Not that there was ethnic cleansing going on there, but the fighting that the Georgian forces had moved into South Ossetia, the supply lines extended at least as far back, and you can look there, Zubdidi was the Air Force base, Poti the Naval base, and...
Well, Zubdidi is closer to Abkhazia.
All right.
Okay, we can... Yeah,
but there's some... It's strictly military... rationale for the extension of the buffer zone, not an ethnic cleansing one. Just those, the supply lines had to be cut. Russian forces, this is the military argument, had to go in, and after those supply lines had been cut, essentially, remember what Russia did, they started to say, okay, we want international observers here now, quickly, okay, so that they can be responsible for preventing the Georgians from rearming, and we can draw back to our original bases.
So then that's a military argument, right?
Yeah.
It's not illegal. There's nothing legal about it.
Well, the legality...
The capital of Georgia has some big supply line. There's Minister of Defense. So
right.
we have to put a checkpoint there to make sure he's not...
But the legality... So, the legality stems from Article 3 of the 94-96 agreement, the JCC memorandum, where it says that the peacekeepers under Russian under the command of the Russian general are responsible not just for keeping order in the territory, but also preventing and, if necessary, pursuing criminal elements beyond. That's the way it was written. Maybe it shouldn't have been written that way, but it does seem to offer at least a plausible argument for pursuing the forces beyond the territory of South Ossetia. Besides which, how can Georgia begin to argue that these internal borders are meaningful when it doesn't want them to exist in the first place? It didn't recognize South Ossetia as an independent, legitimate, having any standing at all. So
yeah, but my trouble with this this point here, Black Sea, is that, you know, Russian peacekeepers in Abkhazia were not attacked.
Good point. In other words, there's a distinction that can be made between what happened in South Ossetia and Abkhazia. Who was bothering Abkhazia, right? It's essentially is the argument. Well, I suppose you could say the jury is still out on that. Of course, the Abkhaz argue, and some documents have been found, and we can argue whether they're legitimate or doctored or whatever, that indicate or suggest that this was a two-pronged attack that was meant to be ended within a week. South Ossetia literally in 2 days, and then, depending on the world's reaction, etc., Abkhazia clearly the second target. What supports this is the division of the forces that were set in motion before August 7th. Of course, 13,000 troops were not mobilized overnight. They actually came off of the exercises that Georgia had undertaken with the U.S. military at the end of July at this very time. And just after that, instead of returning to their bases, they were kept on full mobilization. At which point, however, interestingly, they were split up. One half went to positions prepared to intervene in South Ossetia. The western half were mobilized to intervene, I guess, presumably, in Abkhazia. And one of the reasons, I guess, military specialists now believe that the South Ossetian intervention was not as successful as it could have been is precisely because of that split of forces. If they had indeed focused their forces, maybe they would have done everything more successfully and been in a better position. But they split their forces, again, tending to confirm the supposition that there was a phase A and a phase B, which, of course, Georgia denies.
And finally,
last
question. So if Iranian president reads your article and waits until the Israel bombs Lebanon and then says, well, there were Iranian citizens on Lebanon soil and they were under attack, and we'll start the bombing of Lebanon, would that be legally justified?
Well, the text of why I would go to General Assembly Resolution 3314 and see what it says. A General Assembly resolution is not binding. It is simply an advisory opinion. And it is perhaps significant that nothing more detailed and substantive has come out of the United Nations since then. But such as it is, it is a document of, seven articles, and most of it concerned, as I suppose people were concerned at the time, with the status of and the rights of independence movements in the Third World, Africa, Latin America. Did an indigenous population have the right to support fighters against British colonial rule? That was the context of this resolution. But it doesn't say much, as I recall, regarding civilian populations. But it does specifically mention that an attack on the armed forces of another state is aggression, period. Now, Lavrov has gone beyond that to suggest another wording, saying the attack on the armed forces of another state is the equivalent of an attack on the state, which is different. It's got a slightly different nuance. So I don't know what's going to happen with that formulation. But if you just look at the Article 3314 as it stands, I don't think an attack on Iranian citizens or Iranian citizens who might have be casualties of some bombing in Beirut would constitute sufficient provocation to qualify as aggression. However, I think the case would be stronger under Article 3314 if there happened to be an Iranian peacekeeping battalion on the green line, or maybe there is no more green line. Followed Lebanese politics for a long time. So there on location, and as a result of some intervention by Israel, they were casualties. Now, I think it would be very significant to determine whether they were intentional casualties, as seems to have been the case in Georgia's attack on Sinqali, or incidental, because Israel had a beef with Lebanon, not with Iran. Iranian, even peacekeeping forces just happened to be in the way and couldn't be saved from the collateral damage, essentially. So I think the whole issue of law and area of law regarding responsibility vis-a-vis collateral damage comes into play, and we have a lot of experience in that ourselves. Yeah.
I'm sorry I came late, and so I couldn't follow all of your legal arguments, but I was just wondering what your comment would be about three quick points. One, that Russian military analyst Pavel Feldengauer wrote mm-hmm. that it took many months to get that level of Russian troops down to this area. Of course, I think there were Russian military maneuvers there?
Yes, the week prior. Mm-hmm.
So the second point is that Thomas Goltz, who writes frequently about the Caucasus, said that he happened to be in the region, and I think on the Russian side, that he had happened to stop in a hotel, and if the number is wrong, forgive me, but I think he said there were like 27 or 47 Russian journalists there.
Yeah, this was reported in a variety of areas.
And all I can say is that following the beginning of this operation, whoever started it, or campaign, or whatever, misunderstanding, confrontation, that Russia executed a brilliant media campaign. I was watching Russia Today very closely, reading a lot about it, and the only international, the only non-Russian news service that I can get that had anything that was better was Al Jazeera in English. It had people on the ground, and you could see the tanks in Poti moving a little bit, and then 5 hours later you read about it in BBC News. So I was just wondering, to me, it seems that it can be explained or seen as more than a coincidence that mm-hmm. the Russian military was there, mm-hmm. that the journalists were there, and that there was this ready media campaign. So I was wondering how you would explain that.
Yeah. It's funny because I've heard exactly the same arguments made regarding the Georgians in all three points.
Exactly.
Yeah, they're literally, the two arguments are mirror images of each other, and they each provide evidence. The gist, without knowing the details of who organized what. Maybe there is a grand mastermind to this whole thing that we don't know about yet, we haven't identified. But the gist of the Georgian argument now has come to be that although Georgia acted forcefully, in the face of extreme provocation, and part of this extreme provocation includes exactly the points that you make, going back at least a year before the incident. A number of intervening incidents, incursions over airspace by Russia, Putin giving money to the reconstruction of Abkhaz railways, sending railway, what are called railway troops, essentially, into Abkhazia to do that. and a number of other incidents, which Georgia sees as a litany of provocation leading up to the culminating incident. I think Felgenhauer is not on solid ground when he argues that there was something unusual, if he suggests, which I don't think he actually does, but it's interpreted this way, when he suggests that there was something unusual about the status of Russian forces on the border in July of 2008. The training missions, from what I could tell about the reviews of this particular, discussions of this particular event in July, the events of July, the Russian training exercises had been planned for a long time in advance. They were concluded, and the forces under Russian command basically went back to their status quo before they were demobilized, but at a lessened state of readiness. Although they were still present, because that's where the local base is. So, this was a command unit that was there, but they were not on any special preparedness. In their subsequent interviews given to the press, Medvedev, Putin, a handful of other lesser-known commanders have pointed out that, or suggested that they were caught completely by surprise by these events, and suggest quite directly Georgian duplicity in the matter, because it seems to them that it was targeted not only with respect to the events of the 8th, namely the opening of the Olympic Games in Beijing, when many of the top political leaders would be away, but that in particular the general staff was on vacation that week in Russia. So it took an extraordinary effort to get just the top military command together to actually figure out what was going on and to respond appropriately. You know, I know people still disagree about this. One of the fellows, there's a fellow at, National Endowment for Peace in Washington, Lieutenant Colonel Hamilton, who is preparing a book on this. And he himself was a military advisor in Georgia at the defense, the Georgian Defense Ministry. And he is very much convinced that Georgia is completely blameless in this, and he presents his version of events. The basic counter-argument to these that Russia provides is that these events, certainly Russia was prepared, or should have, it was logical for local military commanders to have contingencies in the event something should happen. But that does not constitute an invasion plan. Or at least, I guess it does, in the sense that we probably have a plan to invade, Iran. I mean, duh, right? Doesn't mean we're going to do it unless specific incidents happen. But there are contingency plans for all sorts of things. So, presumably, I presume that common sense would allow us to acknowledge that there was probably a contingency plan for various scenarios in the Caucasus involving Russian armed forces. But Felgenhauer just adds the additional component to that a political decision was already made. And I don't see the evidence for that.
We have time for one more question.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Are you sure? Okay. Not too long after the war, we get Medvedev giving his sphere of influence speech, that Russia has the right to have a sphere of influence in its in the former Soviet area.
You should. I'm going to talk about this tomorrow.
In my
specifically.
Class,
oh really? Okay. Well, okay.
But I guess what I'm interested in is this Does he go to the geopolitical argument because of the failure of the legal argument in the international community?
Very interesting. If I may, I think your translation is inaccurate.
Okay.
It is not a sphere of influence. It is an area of interests that coincide. And specifically, in a subsequent remark, an interpretation or sort of elaboration that Lavrov gave, he specifically distinguishes between the sphere of influence, which he doesn't say so, but I think it's clear what is meant. It means in terms of a Monroe Doctrine kind of sphere of influence. This is our territory, or this is our interest, but out everybody else. Versus what he calls an area of convergent interests, which is Russia has relations of a certain type that it wishes to promote with some countries, prioritize. With some countries, those priorities might be economic. With other countries, it might be cultural. With others, it might be strategic. There actually is a ranking that Russia has. I suppose it's has something to do with common diplomatic parlance about friendly, then moving up to, I don't know, cordial or something, and then strategic partnership. That's the top category. And so in the process of hopefully Russia moving toward this ultimate strategic partnership with as many nations as possible, or as are willing to enter into such a relationship with Russia, Russia argues will pursue specific priorities in its relationship with neighboring countries, but not as a region and not as an exclusionary policy. That's the thing that Lavrov stressed, and I think is made as a distinction of these types of relationships to a Monroe Doctrine. I can say more about that in terms of the analogy I made at a speech, another speech I gave on specifically foreign policy, was about kind of relations in dating, sort of the difference between saying, okay, this is my girl, nobody else date her, versus I love you very much, you love me a lot, please. And if you want to, you know, date other guys, I don't like that, but I can't stop you from doing so. I'm just going to show you how much I love you, and that'll, you know, that'll convince you. I know it's not a great analogy, but bear with me. I think that's the idea behind the ideal.
Okay.
Sounded good at the time.
We have a request for one quick final question.
Just the what's the phrase in Russian that's in dispute here?
About the price, I'd have to look that up. I can tell you. Actually, what is that? Let me see. I have it right here. I should have it. Let's see. Ah, okay. This does not mean. Okay, blah, blah, blah. All right. This is Medvedev. You could say that these are countries where the Russian Federation has privileged interests. This does not mean that this is some kind of exclusive zone of our interests. This is not the case. There are countries that are very important to us, countries with which we've been living side by side for decades, etc., etc. Russia, now this is Lavrov. Russia has areas where it has privileged interests, not privileged areas. The foreign policy concept says that we will, this was kind of back and forth, there was banter, laughter, the Council on Foreign Relations. Russia will have too much to drink. Russia will develop friendly, mutual, beneficial relations with all those who are prepared to do the same on the equal and mutually beneficial basis, paying particular attention to the traditional partners of the Russian Federation. I think, to me, it sounds more significant maybe than it does to others. But I mean, trying to draw some sort of distinction between privileged interests and privileged areas makes me want to go back and try to figure out what that distinction means in their minds and try to figure that out. I think you can't just subsume both of them under a sphere of interest. They're obviously thinking that they mean something different.
Hey, thank you very much.
Thank you.